When families face food disruption or uncertainty, every meal can feel even more overwhelming, especially with a child who has feeding differences. That's why Feeding Matters created a food access resources page on their It's Not Picky Eating website to help families find state and national resources, as well as guidance and support through Feeding Matters regional community councils. You'll also find a guide to help food banks and community partners better support families of children with feeding disorders and differences, as well as a guide for therapy offices to create community food tables. Visit itsnotpickyeating.org and click the link Food Access Resources.
Presented by Feeding Matters with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
So Teach is a organization out of North Carolina that's responsible for doing trainings on autism. And so they shut down their operations for 2 days. And so we were basically doing talks for their organization. So they had, you know, whatever 100 people there that were at this. And so my presentation was obviously on feeding issues among kids with autism. And so I've had 6 questions for the audience in the first slide where it said, like, I want everybody to think of a dislike food, a food that you really find disgusting. Somebody had water, which I found to be interesting. My favorite is beets because I hate beets and I strongly dislike beets. But yeah, really interesting. And the second question was, can you describe that nasty food? And these are the things that came out. Gross, slimy,
so gross, slimy, nasty. Bitter and disgusting.
And then my next question for the audience was, what would you do if you were asked to eat it? You know, like it was brought to your table and you gag, vomit, cringe,
refuse.
Pray. So I thought that was really cool as a thought exercise.
Yeah.
And then what if a caregiver decided to present it to your lips because you didn't eat the bite? And what would you do, you know, run away, turn, push, spit, you know, basically refuse, hit. And then my final question is, what would you do if you were taken to therapy and taken to a room and asked to eat those items? And so cry, run, hit, hate, you know.
Nope.
Violence, run away. And then I pivoted to my talk by saying, to the audience, like, do you consider these refusal behaviors or reasonable responses to an unreasonable situation? Right. And so, like, that's kind of how we launched the whole activity. So that was fun. It went well.
How did they receive it? Well,
I had other things I was asking them that I already knew. So I asked them, like, when you think of behavioral feeding intervention, what words come to mind? And immediately somebody in the audience said force feeding. We talked a little bit about that. I explained what I view as a behavioral feeding intervention.
Do you feel like it was novel to them, though, the way that you were describing behavioral intervention?
I do.
Yeah.
Because I also had this slide where I had, these are also eaters. So these aren't your feeding tube kids, right? These are kids that already eat some foods, but I had food along a continuum. And I basically said, you know, on the happy side, we're preferred and then accepted and then dropped, or we're kind of your middle. And then your new foods and your non-preferred were like the foods on the bad continuum. And it was having the audience start to think about food and not just like a why don't you eat it type of way. Like, it's more like there's a continuum of like and dislike, just like we all have preference. So, but I thought the audience was receptive. It was right after lunch, and so I think it was a way to wake them up and keep them engaged.
Food talk post lunch.
Yeah, exactly. Anything else? They wanted a lot of information about what to do in school. So
there's a lot of school stuff. We have a school toolkit, Will.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, it might be worth sending them.
Know that.
Mm-hmm. I'll send it to you.
That's cool.
It just came out. It's very new.
Mm-hmm. What I talked about is, like, I don't know if you guys have been to a cafeteria recently with your kids.
It's awful.
It's like, it's the worst place ever. And so, you know, the idea of an accommodation that focuses on trying to get individuals with ARF at a different location to consume their food, or at least some type of accommodation.
Yeah, this has been a really big challenge with my area where, like, I'm going and doing observations directly. And I'm like, first and foremost, this kid gets 15 minutes to eat. Like, that's nothing. You have all these sounds, all these smells, all of these things that are happening in this cafeteria with harsh lights and uncomfortable seating. We are bebopping around. It's a huge challenge. Food is not a primary target for schools, which is understandable because they have so many things that they have to focus on. But again, you don't learn well if your brain isn't nourished.
Mm-hmm.
One mom, there were some moms in the audience. One mom came up to me and said, thank you for, you know, advocating for making preferred and accepted foods the meal, because I send pirate booty to school with my child every day and get pushback from the teachers about, like, can't you send healthier options?
There's so much pushback on, like, send healthy options. And it's just a lack of understanding and awareness of why a parent may be sending a particular preferred food.
Yeah, I've started to tell my parents when they get pushback like that, just to keep asking the question, why? Why is that important to you? We have a team of people that are doing this. Why are you concerned about that? Here are people you can communicate with that can answer your questions.
Mm-hmm. So there is language in the Office of Civil Rights that says that they need to be supported in the way that they eat best successfully. And, you know, and we have pulled that before. For the Department of Public Instruction for students in North Carolina. And, you know, that can be done again. And, you know, it can be done for students anywhere because that comes down nationally.
Yeah. What does the Feeding Matters info about schools have that in there? Or, like, explain to me what you're going to be sending me from an information standpoint for parents or...
So it was done over several months, and what they looked at was, like, what are some of the pieces that a parent or a caregiver may need to be aware of in terms of, like, knowing their rights and, like, knowing how to navigate the system. So there's, like, kind of the information education share side of it. And then there's, like, how do you talk with administration, both not only just, like, teacher in the classroom, but, like, school nurse and larger administration. And so it's got, like, the toolkit has a feeding and eating snapshot, which talks about, like, what are the, like, describe your kid, like, what, how does this show up? What does this look like? What are strategies to use? What are the accommodations that are needed? So it's a lot of description to support the child at school. And the idea is to use it as a tool for awareness in schools, as well as supporting individual families, because we do see so many families that are kind of butting heads up against with schools. I mean, any spectrum of the PFD and ARFID spectrum, it's like on the, like, really critical, like, tube feeding side, there's been awful circumstances in terms of, like, no tube feeding throughout the day, which is just no food throughout the day, and then feeding in a closet or in the nurse's office. And it's just this, like, lack of understanding that this is a meal and it just looks different. To, like, kind of the stuff that Rachel was talking about, like the healthy, unhealthy, we don't think you should bring that mm-hmm. to school type of thing. It's got, like, the IEP stuff, like the rights stuff, but also, like, how to talk about it. And then we're hoping to use it in dissemination to start conversations with schools and schools administration to better help them understand. Because I think a lot of it comes from, like, this child, like, they don't understand that this isn't just a picky eater.
Well, that goes back to the disability kind of understanding.
It does.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. And disability is in there, and it talks about that as well.
When it comes down to calories versus no calories, and this is what's needed to help them best access their education during the day,
mm-hmm.
that's what needs to happen. If pirate's booty is it, then that's what happens.
Right.
I used to do consults to schools, and I found if I could get leadership and administration to have a conversation with me and I explain it, they were really on board, and it was often a lack of understanding and then also understanding what their constraints were. And we would get creative of how to make this work for this child, for their staff, for their constraints, where I felt like it was a win for everyone. And it was interesting. Those school systems then regularly would bring me in, right? When a child would, mm-hmm. right? Like, and it was just a lot of it started with understanding and knowing that we weren't fighting with them. It was how to make it work.
Yeah.
That's so true, because that's a lot of advocacy in general, too, mm-hmm. especially for this issue, is because it's so not well known or understood. It's a lot of like education first before we mm-hmm. get to any sort of fighting. Yes. And mm-hmm. I know there are those situations where fighting is necessary, but.
Yeah.
That's just mm-hmm. that's the hope. So there's there's a whole like local dissemination plan that the committee is undergoing too with that school toolkit. So we'll send it your way, but worth sending to them too if they talked a lot about the school challenges.
Well, and that's where I'm assuming that's where this organization primarily operates a lot in the school systems.
Yeah, so. That makes sense.
And so
they do a lot. Teach does a lot with like universities too to make sure like speech paths and autism specialists and stuff like that are educated before they get out into the real world. So they're really cool.
The other thing we talked about are what we do clinically for schools outside of the school making accommodations is we have kids practice eating in our clinic like they eat at school. So they bring their lunchbox, they unpack it, they put their food out, they eat their preferred foods. And then if they want to start ordering from the menu, we have the parents get a copy of the menu and then us practice eating those items beforehand. Because to your point about the chaos of the cafeteria, that should be like that sounds like a great whatever you want to call it.
It does. You named it.
Yeah. Chaos of the cafeteria. It is like an overwhelming spot that like, especially for kids who are anxious about eating. So like actually going out, practicing eating those items before you get to the cafeteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do a lot of that in my therapy with getting their menus and like going through and figuring out what's closest to their safe foods. It's a lot of hard work, but it does help them feel more confident, and the peer interaction of their peers eating the same thing has been helpful too.
There was also a lot of interest in PFD and ARFID that we talked at the end about the need for medical screening before you start working on introducing food. So that was kind of universally, some people share in the audience their personal experience. But you know what, going back to, you know, there was enough interest in feeding and eating disorders and autism to make, you know, there was only six speakers. And so one of the six was obviously me. But to have that as a topic, I just found that to be so interesting that is such a concern among the community of autism. That
Well, and I appreciate that they've kind of honed in on there's the feeding disorder and the eating disorder side of it. And then they had the questions about the PFD turning into ARFID and all those things.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. I think that's like a level of awareness that I don't think was there previously, that it's nice to see that there are people interested and curious about it.
Well, I had moved that content to the end of my talk and I had about 20 minutes left or 30 minutes left. I forget. I had some time left. And I said to the audience, I could talk about this or I could talk about this. And they overwhelmingly said, talk about PFD and ARFID. So it was like big vote.
Oh, good. Good. That means it's making a difference.
Like, well, who were the other speakers?
Oh, man.
Oh.
Now you're they were, I'm going to tell you.
And they were all within feeding, eating world or other aspects of autism?
No, it was all autism.
Oh, other aspects. Okay.
Yeah.
But you were the only feeding person.
Oh,
correct.
Okay.
That's what I mean. Uh-oh. So that's
why they wanted him to,
But to be invited, I consider what we do is a very niche area, right? I mean, I think ARFID is niche, PFD is niche. I mean, I know we're trying to make it more not niche, but it is niche at this point because we can count on our hand, you know, the same people.
Community is so small.
Yeah. Related to the eating disorders community, kind of adopting ARFID and then applying like an anorexia type of approach to an ARFID treatment.
Yeah. Yes, it's awful.
I'm working on a paper, hopefully that will come out, called ARFID is not anorexia.
Yes.
Or that's the working name, but I've learned so much recently. Do you guys know that anorexia was around in the Middle Ages?
Yes.
Like anorexia has been around for like the 1500s, like that it's been a thing.
Do you think there's a lot of misdiagnoses of anorexia before the realization of ARFID?
It could be. I mean, what I just found fascinating is that ARFID, it came about in 2013, right? And we're talking hundreds of years where this condition called anorexia has been in the nomenclature. So Haley, I went back to your paper. This is kind of where I might springboard for this paper I'm working on. I went back to your paper and started looking at the conceptualization that's happened over time for what's now ARFID and PFD. And yeah. You only go back to 1945. So anorexia has like a much longer history of being something that people have had discussions about. And I think that's why the natural inclination of clinicians and researchers be like, oh, we can apply this anorexia framework to ARFID in you know, restricted yeah. eating pediatrics, when it, sure. it doesn't have it. It's they're completely opposite diagnoses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's so interesting. Y'all are bringing this up because I would love to have a talk to you about what this looks like for acute care management. So then once our providers get them in the community, they understand the all the medical piece, like what actually happened with refeeding syndrome, you know, their cardiac changes, orthostatic changes, things like that. So when kids start getting into trouble at home, they have some major medical red flags of when they need to go to a higher level of care. So I feel like we're missing that piece because most recently we've had two children come in that we thought were ARFID. And then when you start diving into it, it was actually, it was anorexia for one and it was orthorexia for the other with really significant mental health concerns where we had to completely just not even focus on the food. You know, use a tube, and they had to go into acute care for psychiatric support. So it's like we're seeing them go both. We're seeing families and kids go both directions because we're still trying to figure it out.
Well, and in some of the Facebook support groups that I run, we see that a lot of us were misdiagnosed. Like I was told, oh, you're anorexic. No, you're bulimic. Oh, wait, no, you're neither. And so I think that's a really important mm-hmm. piece to kind of keep in mind, but also too recognizing you can have both. Mm-hmm. But I will say, I definitely think to Jacqueline's point, it has the fact that it hasn't been recognized as long as it needs to have been.
It's all over this document. Like you look at like, so I get Will's point of the infrastructure of anorexia and how that's like really like over. It's just such a more sophisticated, and that's what we've known about the eating disorder world for a while in comparison to the feeding disorder world. But look at like back in the Middle Ages, how it was like the conceptualization of it. It's mm-hmm. so intertwined. I think, Will, I don't know if you've interpreted it that way.
Well, I've just been, so I found this paper because I thought I started with Haley's paper and I was like, okay, so we've known about like childhood feeding restriction from the 1945s in terms of your evolutionary concept, right? We've talked about it. But then
that was describing infants versus looking at like adults.
Right. So then I typed in like anorexia, how long has it been around? Right. And I landed on this paper that was written that it's called the paper's entitled, for those interested, Historical Evolution of the Concept of Anorexia Nervosa and Relationships with Orthorexia Nervosa, Autism and Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. Yeah. But so that was fascinating for me. And then when I started telling people, because I like to tell people facts I learned, I said, do you know anorexia has been around since the friggin' Middle Ages? And, you know, you're worrying about survival back in the Middle Ages. So this whole idea of disorder, like our disordered relationship with food being a thing as way back as that is pretty fascinating.
Well, I mean, but when you even like go back into like the CBT construct for ARFID, like what they have now available, they talk about the Neanderthal brain. I mean, we had to do this back when they were cavemen, I mean, to survive. So it was more of like an environmental force rather than a mental health situation. But I mean, these things have been around since day one. You can't tell me that people's mental health was perfect.
No, yeah. Like,
you know?
Well, the other thing I've been talking about that's related to that is I've been talking, the way I've been framing ARFID or anxiety in general is like, we're all the survivors, right? Like we are the descendants of survivors. And survivors had to have a little anxiety to make sure they didn't die, right? Like a little bit. And food's something that can kill you. And so we have this kind of conflicting thing. We need to survive, but also we need to make sure we don't eat something that could be significantly dangerous. So it makes sense that we have these mechanisms that could go awry or get co-opted and become disordered.
Coming in 2026, the Feeding Matters International Pediatric Feeding Disorder Conference explores the theme, Feeding Development, where systems, skills, and stories connect. This entirely virtual conference includes over 30 hours of continuing education with keynote sessions from Emory Center for Ethics Professor John Leisiker and from the family nutritionist Alexandra Turnbull. Attend live virtually February 25th through the 27th and view on demand March 9th through April 30th. Visit feedingmatters.org/conference to learn more. Register by December 31st and save $50 with early bird pricing.